You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's been almost a month since protests began at Columbia University in New York, where students established a Gaza solidarity encampment to demand that the university divest from companies associated with the State of Israel. With similar protests subsequently springing up at campuses across the globe, with students making similar calls to their universities to divest from Israel, the issue of ethical and responsible investment has become widely discussed in academic institutions across the globe. Following a recent pro-Palestinian protest at the University of Auckland, an open letter and petition has been sent to the University of Auckland Foundation to divest from companies that are involved in gross human rights violations and weapons manufacturing. The letter has been signed by a number of professors, faculty members, and students who are concerned about the University of Auckland's possible investment ties and are calling for the university to adopt a more ethical investment framework. I spoke to Dr. Ritesh Shah, a senior lecturer in critical studies in education and co-author of the letter, to discuss the calls for divestment to the university. We also spoke a little bit about the current situation in Rafah, which he had also been researching.
Tell us about the open letter to the University of Auckland Foundation.
So we've started a campaign, a number of students, staff, and alumni, to ask the University of Auckland Foundation, of which there are two, the University of Auckland Foundation and the Medical and Health Sciences Foundation, to divest from companies that are involved in human rights violations, as well as those that are involved in arms weapons production or technologies for the defense industry. We're also asking for the University of Auckland to sign up to the UN Developed Principles for Responsible Investment, which a number of other institutions in our region have already signed up to.
So which companies does the foundation have ties with that might be involved in weapons production or human rights violations?
This is a great question, and it's something that the foundation has not been very forthcoming on. In past requests under the Official Information Act, the foundation has not shared or divulged that information. They do have a fund manager that works through and looks at the university's portfolio of around $400 million. A lot of that is tied up in managed funds. So I imagine that there would be a range of different corporations within that portfolio. However, to date, we have not had any transparency as to who are the specific corporations that the university has shares in as part of that fund.
So as I understand it, the letter not only calls for the university to divest from companies that might be involved in human rights violations, but also calls for the university to adopt the Principles for Reasonable Investment framework. As it says in the letter, Victoria University of Wellington and the University of Melbourne have adopted this framework into their investment policy. So why do you think that the University of Auckland hasn't done the same yet?
I mean, I think maybe in part because there hasn't been pressure to do so. The University of Auckland foundations have been, I think, quite slow to respond to changing public sentiment. We know in Aotearoa at the moment that there is a real commitment and desire amongst the general public to see their KiwiSaver funds, their super funds, vested responsibly. And we can see that many of these funds are making moves in that direction. I just think that there's not been a lot of transparency over the endowments that universities hold, including our own institution. And so I think that does require a little bit of public pressure. We know from a five-year campaign between 2014 and 2019 that it eventually led to the foundation agreeing to divest from companies involved in exacerbating climate change and fossil fuel production specifically. But that took 5 years of active public pressure to ensure that that happened.
How many faculty members have signed the open letter so far?
So far, as of now, we have about 275 signatories, and that is comprised of students, staff, and alumni of the University of Auckland. We have several professors and senior academics. We have several distinguished alumni and students really from all over the world who have signed up to this request for the University of Auckland to take action.
Given the support from university faculty and students, do you have confidence in the University of Auckland Foundation to commit to divestment as well as adopting the PRI framework?
I am going to operate in a principle of good faith and presume that the university at least will enter into dialogue on this and begin to explain and explore what steps it can take immediately and what steps it might need a bit longer to resolve. I think we're hoping to have a productive conversation rather than it to move into a more combative situation.
So if I can just touch on maybe another topic that you've been involved in.
Yeah.
Recently, you spoke with the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council's mission in Palestine regarding the situation in Rafah at the moment. So could you tell our listeners a bit about what's happening there and what refugees in Rafah are currently facing at the moment?
Sure. I mean, and this was on Monday that I had that conversation, and since that time things have changed. But at that time and in the period since, as we know, Israel has launched an offensive against Rafah, as well as re-engaged in an offensive in the north of Gaza, specifically communities like Jabalia and Bet Hanun, Bet Lahia in the very north. What this has led to is the displacement of around 550,000 people in the last week. It's about 25% of Gaza's total population. And of course, these are people who have been displaced multiple times since October 7th. They are being moved, or many of them are moving into a very narrow and desolate piece of sand dunes and beach at the southwestern tip of Gaza, which is known as the Al-Mawasi camp now. There is nowhere near sufficient water and sanitation facilities, availability of food, availability of clean drinking water. The biggest concern, though, at the moment is actually the fact that most of the humanitarian aid, truckloads of humanitarian, have stopped completely because prior to the start of the offensive, most of that was coming in through either Kerem Shalom or Rafah border crossing. The Israelis have now closed or taken over those crossings. There's very little aid getting in. And that is likely to lead to acute issues around malnutrition, the closure of hospitals, and the lack of availability of clean drinking water, and so on.
Many of Israel's closest Western allies have urged for Israel to continue the flow of aid into Gaza, and also said that an invasion of Rafah would basically cross a red line. So do you think that the situation at the moment in Rafah will finally result in stronger action from Western governments towards Israel?
Well, we're starting to see that already. And you know, I think this is an interesting turn of events. You know, we've seen the United States come out with some of its strongest statements of concern and sanction against Israel's actions in Rafah. You know, the refusal to send a small amount of heavy munitions to Israel is a small step. But we know that there's a lot more munitions that have been sent. I mean, I think the other thing that was done intentionally was the release of the report last week by the State Department, which indicated that Israel was likely complicit in using weapons in breach of international human rights law. And I think that things like Egypt joining the ICC case that was started by South Africa is also an interesting turn of events. Egypt, who has long time been a strong ally of Israel and helped to kind of securitize the Gaza border, all of a sudden is now taking Israel to court along with the South African government. So yes, there are small cracks, but I would say that, and this is where I think we need to look at what's been happening globally in the last few weeks, and to say that I think that student movements, the student protests, are having an impact, particularly on public sentiment, political sentiment across many of Israel's allies. I think politicians are starting to read the tea leaves and recognizing that their population is kind of concerned about what stance or lack of accountability their governments have had towards Israel and demanding a stronger stance on this and challenging Israel's refusal to really back down against a conflict that I think the United States itself has said Israel doesn't have a clear plan for what's going to happen if and when they topple Hamas.
Do you think that the recent protests at the University of Auckland and similar protests across Aotearoa have had an impact on our government here as well?
It's a bit harder to see with our government how that's having concrete change at the moment. I mean, our government has come out along with the governments of Australia and Canada at several points in the past few months, condemning the actions of Israel, asking for Israel to demonstrate restraint in what it's carrying out in terms of operations in Rafah. So I'm not sure it's really shifted sentiment on that level. I think what's interesting, though, and the opposition put forth this idea yesterday, is that we should be pushing for humanitarian visas for those in Gaza who would like to get out and would like to reach a place of safety. And this campaign has been going on for a few months now, and the government has kind of stalled on this. And so I think this is an area where it would be great to see the government taking some action.
Just going back to the situation in Rafah, the IDF has instructed refugees currently in Rafah to relocate to Al-Mawasi, which is a small town approximately 20% the size of Rafah. So since the confinement of 1.4 million people in Rafah has already been a major humanitarian concern, what do you think will happen when refugees are made to relocate to Al-Mawasi?
I think it's quite terrifying, to be honest. And speaking to those who had to be displaced from places like Gaza City to the south, one of the challenges is, of course, the scarcity of resources, whether it's clean drinking water, whether it's food, whether it's even access to a toilet. And unfortunately, when you confine so many people to such a small space with such limited resources, there is a real risk of violence breaking out within the camps, a lack of security, and then alongside that, just an inability to maintain a basic standard of care and living standards to help people to survive. We are talking literally about a part of Gaza that is just sand dunes. It was totally barren land. There was nothing there. There are no services. There is no electricity. And all of a sudden, you have probably at this point around 1 million people who are camped on this patch of sand.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.